Chapter 6. Matters of the Heart. The natives will tell you South Florida has four seasons. Subtle ones, they admit, but four distinct seasons nonetheless. Do not believe them. There are only two, the warm dry season and the hot wet one. It was about the time of this overnight return to tropical swelter when we awoke one day to realize our puppy was a puppy no more. As rapidly as winter had morphed into summer, it seemed, Marley had morphed into a gangly adolescent. At 5 months old, his body had filled out the baggy wrinkles in its oversized yellow fur coat. His enormous paws no longer looked so comically out of proportion. His needle-sharp baby teeth had given way to imposing fangs that could destroy a frisbee or a brand-new leather shoe in a few quick chomps. The timbre of his bark had deepened to an intimidating boom. When he stood on his hind legs, which he did often, tottering around like a dancing Russian circus bear, he could rest his front paws on my shoulders and look me straight in the eye. The first time the veterinarian saw him, he let out a soft whistle and said, "You're going to have a big boy on your hands." We were not the only ones to notice the transformation. We could tell from the wide berth strangers gave him and the way they recoiled when he bounded their way that they no longer viewed him as a harmless puppy. To them, he had grown into something to be feared. Our front door had a small oblong window at eye level, 4 inches wide by 8 inches long. Marley lived for company, and whenever someone rang the bell, he would streak across the house, going into a full skid as he approached the foyer, careening across the wood floors, tossing up throw rugs as he slid, and not stopping until he crashed into the door with a loud thud. He then would hop up on his hind legs, yelping wildly, his big head filling the tiny window, to stare straight into the face of whoever was on the other side. For Marley, it was a joyous overture. For anyone else who didn't know him, though, it was as if Cujo had just jumped out of the Stephen King novel, and the only thing that stood between them and a merciless mauling was our wooden door. More than one stranger, after ringing the doorbell and seeing Marley's barking face peering out at them, beat a quick retreat to the middle of the driveway, where they stood waiting for one of us to answer. This, we found, was not necessarily a bad thing. Ours was what urban planners call a changing neighborhood. Built in the 1940s and 50s and initially populated by snowbirds and retirees, it began to take on a gritty edge as the original homeowners died off and were replaced by a motley group of renters and working-class families. By the time we moved in, the neighborhood was again in transition, this time being gentrified by gays, artists, and young professionals drawn to its location near the water and its funky deco-style architecture. Our block served as a buffer between hard-bitten South Dixie Highway and the posh estate homes along the water. The neighborhood seemed safe to us, but there were telltales of its rough edge. Tools left out in the yard disappeared, and during a rare cold spell, someone stole every stick of firewood I had stacked along the side of the house. One Sunday, we were eating breakfast at our favorite diner, sitting at the table we always sat at, right in the front window, when Jenny pointed to a bullet hole in the plate glass just above our heads. That definitely wasn't there last time we were here. Most unsettling of all was what we learned about the small house kitty-corner from ours. A murder had taken place there just a few months before we moved in, and not just a run-of-the-mill murder, but a horribly gruesome one involving an invalid widow and a chainsaw. The victim was a retired schoolteacher named Ruth Ann Niedermeyer, who had lived in the house alone and was one of the original settlers of the neighborhood. After hip replacement surgery, she had hired a day nurse to help care for her, which was a fatal decision. The nurse, police later ascertained, had been stealing checks out of Mrs. Niedermeyer's checkbook and forging her signature. The old woman had been frail but mentally sharp, and she confronted the nurse about the missing checks and the unexplained charges to her bank account. The panicked nurse bludgeoned the poor woman to death, then called her boyfriend, who arrived with a chainsaw and helped her dismember the body in the bathtub. Together, they packed the body parts in a large trunk, rinsed the woman's blood down the drain, and drove away. For several days, Mrs. Niedermeyer's disappearance remained a mystery, our neighbors later told us. The mystery was solved when a man called the police to report a horrible stench coming from his garage. Officers discovered the trunk and its ghastly contents. When they asked the homeowner how it got there, he told them the truth. His daughter had asked if she could store it there for safekeeping. Although the grisly murder of Mrs. Niedermeyer was the most talked about event in the history of our block, no one had mentioned a word about it to us as we prepared to buy the house. Our first week in the house, the neighbors came over with cookies and a casserole and broke the news to us. As we lay in our bed at night, it was hard not to think that just 100 feet from our bedroom window, a defenseless widow had been sawn into pieces. Somehow, having Marley aboard with us, and seeing how strangers eyed him so warily, gave us a sense of peace we might not have had otherwise. He was a big, loving dope of a dog whose defense strategy against intruders would surely have been to lick them to death. But the prowlers and predators out there didn't need to know that. To them, he was big, he was powerful, and he was unpredictably crazy. And that is how we liked it. Pregnancy suited Jenny well. She began rising at dawn to exercise and walk Marley. She prepared wholesome, healthy meals loaded with fresh vegetables and fruits. She swore off caffeine and diet sodas, and of course, all alcohol, not even allowing me to stir a tablespoon of cooking sherry into the pot. We had sworn to keep the pregnancy a secret until we were confident the fetus was viable, but on this front, neither of us did well. We were so excited that we dribbled out our news to one confidant after another, swearing each to silence, until our secret was no longer a secret at all. Jenny's stomach at 10 weeks was starting to round slightly. By the time the day arrived for Jenny's examination and sonogram, we might as well have plastered it on a billboard. John and Jenny are expecting. I took off work the morning of the doctor's appointment and, as instructed, brought a blank videotape so I could capture the first grainy images of our baby. The appointment was to be part checkup, part informational meeting. We arrived at 9 a.m., brimming with anticipation. The nurse midwife, a gentle middle-aged woman with a British accent, led us into a small exam room and immediately asked, "Would you like to hear your baby's heartbeat?" "Would we ever," we told her. We listened intently as she ran a sort of microphone hooked to a speaker over Jenny's abdomen. We sat in silence, smiles frozen on our faces, straining to hear the tiny heartbeat. But only static came through the speaker. The nurse said that was not unusual. "It depends on how the baby is lying. Sometimes you can't hear anything. It might still be a little early." She offered to go right to the sonogram. "Our first glimpse of baby Grogi," Jenny said, beaming at me. The nurse midwife led us into the sonogram room and had Jenny lie back on a table with a monitor screen beside it. "I brought a tape," I said, waving it in front of her. "Just hold on to it for now," the nurse said as she pulled up Jenny's shirt and began running an instrument the size and shape of a hockey puck over her stomach. We peered at the computer monitor. She zoomed in on what looked like a tiny sack in the middle of the sea of gray, and with the click of a mouse magnified it, then magnified it again. But despite the great detail, the sack just looked like an empty, shapeless sock to us. Where were the little arms and legs the pregnancy book said would be formed by 10 weeks? Where was the tiny head? Where was the beating heart? Jenny, her neck craned sideways to see the screen, was still brimming with anticipation, and asked the nurse with a little nervous laugh, "Is there anything in there?" I looked up to catch Essie's face, and I knew the answer was the one we did not want to hear. Suddenly I realized why she hadn't been saying anything as she kept clicking up the magnification. She answered Jenny in a controlled voice, "Not what you'd expect to see at 10 weeks. I put my hand on Jenny's knee. We both continued staring at the blob on the screen as though we could will it to life. "Jenny, I think we have a problem here," Essie said. "Let me get Dr. Sherman." As we waited in silence, I learned what people mean when they describe the swarm of locusts that descends just before they faint. I felt the blood rushing out of my head and heard buzzing in my ears. If I don't sit down, I thought, I'm going to collapse. How embarrassing would that be? My strong wife bearing the news stoically as her husband lay unconscious on the floor, the nurses trying to revive him with smelling salts. I half sat on the edge of the examining bench, holding Jenny's hand with one of mine and stroking her neck with the other. Tears welled in her eyes, but she didn't cry. Dr. Sherman, a tall, distinguished-looking man with a gruff but affable demeanor, confirmed that the fetus was dead. "We'd be able to see a heartbeat, no question," he said. He gently told us what we already knew from the books we had been reading, that 1 in 6 pregnancies ends in miscarriages, that this was nature's way of sorting out the weak, the retarded, the grossly deformed. Apparently remembering Jenny's worry about the flea sprays, he told us it was nothing we did or did not do. He placed his hand on Jenny's cheek and leaned in close as if to kiss her. "I'm sorry," he said. "You can try again in a couple of months." We both just sat there in silence. The blank videotape sitting on the bench beside us suddenly seemed like an incredible embarrassment. I wanted to hide it. I asked the doctor, "Where do we go from here?" "We have to remove the placenta," he said. "Years ago, you wouldn't have even known you had miscarried yet, and you would have waited until you started hemorrhaging." He gave us the option of waiting over the weekend and returning on Monday for the procedure, which was the same as an abortion, with the fetus and placenta being vacuumed from the uterus. But Jenny wanted to get it behind her, and so did I. "Okay then," Dr. Sherman said. He gave her something to force her to dilate and was gone. Down the hall, we could hear him enter another exam room and boisterously greet an expectant mother with jolly banter. Alone in the room, Jenny and I fell heavily into each other's arms and stayed that way until a light knock came at the door. It was an older woman we had never seen before. She carried a sheaf of papers. "I'm sorry, sweetie," she said to Jenny. "I'm so sorry." And then she showed her where to sign the waiver acknowledging the risks of uterine suction. Afterwards, in the car, Jenny maintained a detached silence, pressing herself against the passenger door, gazing out the window. Her eyes were red, but she would not cry. I searched for comforting words without success. Really, what could be said? We had lost our baby. Yes, I could tell her we could try again. I could tell her that many couples go through the same thing. But she didn't want to hear it, and I didn't want to say it. Someday we would be able to see it all in perspective. But not today. When we arrived at the house, I helped Jenny inside and onto the couch, then went into the garage where Marley, as always, awaited our return with breathless anticipation. As soon as he saw me, he dove for his oversized rawhide bone and proudly paraded it around the room, his body wagging, tail whacking the washing machine like a mallet on a kettle drum. He begged me to try to snatch it from him. "Not today, pal," I said, and let him out the back door into the yard. He took a long pee and then came barreling back inside and careened down the hall searching for Jenny. It took me just a few seconds to follow him into the living room. When I turned the corner, I stopped short. I would have bet a week's pay that what I was looking at couldn't possibly happen. Our rambunctious, wired dog stood with his shoulders between Jenny's knees, his big, blocky head resting quietly in her lap. His tail hung flat between his legs, the first time I could remember it not wagging whenever he was touching one of us. His eyes were turned up at her, and he whimpered softly. She stroked his head a few times, and then, with no warning, buried her face in the thick fur of his neck and began sobbing. Hard, unrestrained, from the gut, sobbing. They stayed like that for a long time, Marley statue still, Jenny clutching him to her like an oversized doll. I stood off to the side, feeling like a voyeur, intruding on this private moment. not quite knowing what to do with myself. And then, without lifting her face, she raised one arm up toward me, and I joined her on the couch and wrapped my arms around her. There, the three of us stayed, locked in our embrace of shared grief.